This is Paddington. Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
Imagine being the statue of Isambard Kingdom Brunel at London Paddington Station. Well, I guess to do that, you'd have to know who Isambard Kingdom Brunel was. Sorry in advance if you're one of the thousands of Brits who voted him into second place in that Greatest Britons of All Time poll from 2002, ahead of Darwin, Shakespeare, Newton, Diana, Dickens, behind only Winston Churchill. Probably can't believe I'm about to start from the basics. But if you're like me, then you've never heard Brunel's name brought up in the conversation about great minds that shaped the modern world. Isambard Kingdom Brunel isn't a name you'd easily forget, after all. So, born in 1806, father was a French engineer who'd fled during the French Revolution. When Isambard was young, Marc Brunel was put in charge of building a tunnel under the Thames, which doesn't sound like such a big deal now, but this was only the first ever tunnel to go underwater. Marc personally designed a shield to prevent cave-ins, which is pretty much the same thing we use to tunnel today. All the same, a flooding incident in the tunnel nearly killed his 22-year-old boy, Isambard, in 1828. The other six men with Isambard that day drowned. Isambard probably should have as well. No matter. In 1833, Isambard Brunel, only 27, is named Chief Engineer of the Great Western Railway. His mission is to survey and build a line from London to Bristol. His dream is to build a steam-powered pathway from London all the way to New York. So at the same time that Brunel is taming the English countryside with bridges and tunnels, he's setting out to prove that steamships can make it all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. Not a consensus opinion in those days. But, if you do the math, and Brunel did, bigger ships can carry way more cargo without experiencing way more resistance. Triple the size, and you don't have to triple the fuel. In 1838, he both opens the first Paddington station, sending trains west from it, and he sees the steamship the Great Western, at the time the longest ship in the world, off on its maiden voyage. When Queen Victoria made her first ever train journey in 1842, Isambard was on board making sure everything went all right on the way to London Paddington. Pretty much everything he would build from that point forward, two progressively larger iron steamships, bridges, tunnels, would be the largest of their kind the world had ever seen. Not every Brunel idea was practical, but pretty much every idea was innovative. Probably rendered impractical by being decades ahead of its time. Nearly everything he did had contemporaries clutching their pearls and calling him mad. Isambard Kingdom Brunel was the revolutionary in the Industrial Revolution. So you're the statue of Brunel in Paddington Station. You built this station. Those three gently arcing train sheds overhead with wrought iron holding in glass that was inspired by the Crystal Palace in Hyde Park. Glass that floods the station with light. You dreamt that up. The train lines that leave here for Bristol and the viaducts, tunnels, and bridges those trains will traverse along the way. Those were once mere visions in your mind. That mind was one of the greatest minds of its age, or any age. A mind that changed the world and literally changed time. Brunel's fast trains suddenly made it important that all cities actually knew what time it was in Greenwich. So everywhere, time stopped and sped up to suit Isambard Kingdom Brunel. In fact, you can hear Brunel talk about all of this.
Hello. Isambard Kingdom Brunel here.
As part of a recent Talking Statues initiative, you can listen to the engineer, as played by Hugh Bonneville, tell you about his tireless pursuit to change the way the world moved.
I wanted to create the world's first train for people. People who had never seen the sea. And people who had never seen our great city of London, speeding past each other en route.
But that's probably not the Paddington-related role you know Hugh Bonneville for.
Well, obviously what first attracted me to the project was the very name Paddington. Because for, like millions of people around the world, Paddington was part of my childhood.
And I think Brunel would have had some choice words to say about that as well. because the statue of Brunel has to deal with schmucks like me who come to Paddington Station and walk right by him, unknowing, thinking he's just another sideburn sculpture with a top hat in a city full of them. I imagine he watches people rushing over to Platform 1 to take selfies with Paddington Station's other fuzzy-faced, behatted sculpture and thinks, why does everyone love this damn bear that stole my station's name so damn much? He's not even real. Welcome back to Iconography, a podcast about the geography of icons, real and imagined. It's sort of weird going to London Paddington Station, because the most famous thing that ever happened there...
Mr. and Mrs. Brown first met Paddington on a railway station.
...never actually happened. It's not as if there's a dearth of non-imagined events that happen at Paddington. Between the Paddington Bear statue on Platform 1 and the Paddington Bear store in the lawn section of the station, you can take the stairs down to the London Underground, the circulatory system that keeps London's lifeblood pumping. The first underground service, actually, the first ever subway service in the world, left Paddington Station early in the morning in 1863. Within 3 hours, this was the scene. Every station became crowded, and the constant cry as the trains arrived of, "No room!" appeared to have a very depressing effect upon those assembled. Yeah, that seems about right. That morning in 1863 irrevocably changed how cities would function going forward. Pretty darn significant, if you ask me. But the event that has defined Paddington Station more than any other did not involve this first in locomotives, oh no. It happened almost a century later, a pleasant middle-class family happening upon a lonely bear from darkest Peru and taking him in, marmalade jar and all. It happened, all of it, in the mind of a young cameraman who worked in the equally young medium of television. Michael Bond was born January 13th, 1926. 13 days later, John Logie Baird gave the first public demonstration of what would become the defining medium of the 20th century. Television. The two, Bond and television, were practically bosom buddies. They stayed close. As a teenager, Bond impressed a BBC man with his offhand knowledge of Ohm's law and got a job working on a transmitter in his hometown of Reading. He was working on it when a German air raid killed 41. Later on, as a young man, after serving in the war, he returned to the BBC, this time as a cameraman. He wrote on the side, but his day job for almost 20 years was developing the look of television entertainment in its early days when, as Bond put it, everything was held together by string. In middle age, Bond moved out from behind the camera to focus on his burgeoning writing career, but he continued to work with the BBC. He developed the children's show The Herbs with stop-motion animator Ivor Wood, which debuted in 1968. 7 years later, in 1975, Wood came to Bond with an idea for adapting Bond's most beloved character for the BBC. "To tell you the truth," he said, "I've been playing around with an idea for filming Paddington." That idea was to emphasize the talking bear's alienness by having him be the only 3D object in a 2D world. Paddington was an adorable stop-motion teddy bear in a tall hat and a blue jacket, and any object he touched, one of his beloved marmalade sandwiches for instance, was full and round like him. But the world around Paddington, the Brown family, their house, everything, was sketches on cardboard. That aesthetic carried over to the voices as well. One man, Michael Holdern, narrated the entire series of 5-minute shorts.
"Is that one of them?" asked the driver. "He's covered in white stuff." "It's only cream," said Judy. "I dare say," said the driver. "But bears is sixpence extra. Sticky bears is ninepence." "Ninepence extra," exclaimed Paddington hotly. He directed a hard stare at the driver.
Television had come quite a long way from Bond's early days at the BBC. The show aired during Bond's 50th birthday, and television was getting up there in years, too. But Michael Bond and Ivor Wood were intentionally hearkening back to the days when everything was held together by string. Fast forward. In 2007, as an old man, Bond harumphed and apologized for a series of commercials for Marmite that saw the BBC Paddington, plush in his cardboard world, trying a new sandwich spread.
Paddington, you'll remember from childhood, always keeps a marmalade sandwich for emergencies. I've always had marmalade, thought Paddington. Maybe I ought to try something different. Mmm, really rather good.
The medium of television had grown so old it was eating its own tail to survive. Michael Bond had grown quite old as well. Those folks that this Marmite ad was targeting, who remembered the 1976 Paddington TV show from childhood, they were in their 30s and 40s by 2007. Bond was twice their age. Michael Bond passed away last month at 91 years old. That's a lot of years, but not so many that Michael Bond was not a thoroughly modern man. Paddington Bear may seem timeless, ageless, but the man who dreamt him up built transmission towers. He flew planes, though not for long due to air sickness. He operated color television cameras, and he even recorded a YouTube video about a mobile app.
When it was suggested that a vehicle painter might be digitalized, I must admit to feeling a bit uneasy about the whole thing. I need to worry. The exciting new dimension has been added, and it works wonders. In fact, it's so exciting I want to dash out and tell everyone all about it, but instead, taking advantage of the same kind of magic, here I am, sitting at my computer instead.
One other thing we should consider about the year Michael Bond was born. In 1926, the first volume of Winnie the Pooh stories was published by A.A. Milne. Milne, as you might know, based the Winnie the Pooh stories on the playthings of his son, Christopher Robin Milne, a set of stuffed animals that included a teddy bear named Edward. The name Winnie actually came from a bear that the Milne men would visit at the London Zoo named Winnipeg. He'd been brought over during the First World War by a Canadian soldier who donated him to the zoo when the war was won. The teddy bear was still a pretty new concept when A.A. Milne wrote his first story based on Christopher's little friend, Edward. When Milne's story, The Teddy Bear, was published in 1924, teddy bears were only 22 years from their creation. That's about how far we are now from the arrival of Tickle Me Elmo. Put another way, A.A. Milne wouldn't have had a teddy bear when he was a child. It didn't exist yet. The teddy bear has had a remarkable run as a symbol of childhood, of childhood's evocative power, and also its remarkable brevity, considering it's only a little over a century old. From Winnie the Pooh all the way through to Lotso Huggin' Bear and Ted, the teddy bear has been many things to many different artists. Even those two most recent examples show the versatility of the icon.
Thunder Buddies for life, right, Johnny? All right, come on, let's sing the thunder song.
All right. When you hear the sound of...
Ted is Seth MacFarlane's raunchy embodiment of arrested adolescence, of our inability to let go of childhood.
What are y'all doing? Running back to your kid? He don't want you no more.
That's a lie.
Is it? Tell me this, Sheriff. If your kid loves you so much, why is he leaving? You think you're special, cowboy? You're a piece of plastic. You were made to be thrown away.
Lotso Huggin' Bear, like every toy in the Toy Story films, is Pixar's somber meditation on how fleeting childhood is, how fast children grow up and move on. And Lotso isn't anything new. He is the latest in a line of lonely, abandoned bears that includes Don Freeman's corduroy, who searched the department store all night looking for his missing button so that he might be wanted. And then, of course, there was Michael Bond's Paddington, who was inspired by a stuffed bear that had been left behind unwanted on a shelf at Selfridges on Christmas Eve.
It started to snow, and I went into Selfridges, we went into the toy department, and came across this one bear sitting on the shelf, looking very sorry for itself. And it sounds a bit odd, perhaps, because I walked away and then I went back. Somehow I felt sorry for this bear.
I think there's a sense that writing for children is easy. It's not. It requires being attuned to a special frequency, one that lets you see magic in the most mundane objects and opportunity in the most ordinary scenarios. You see past a bear on a shelf and wrestle with what's behind it. Possibility. Just look at Pooh, Paddington, and Corduroy. Three authors looked at fundamentally the same thing, a stuffed bear, completely ephemeral outside of the connection it might make with one child. And all three went in wildly different directions. A.A. Milne focused on the bear-child connection in full bloom. Christopher Robin's uninhibited imagination became the 100-acre wood, where his playthings got up to mischief while he was away. Freeman focused Corduroy on the quest for that connection, and how consumerism could get in the way. A proto-Toy Story, if you will. The key for him was the department store where products vie for our attention. And Michael Bond, who was confronted with that exact consumerist image at Selfridges in 1956, on Christmas Eve no less, the Thunderdome of consumerism, somehow he saw miles past that and abstracted this whole idea down to connection itself, compassion between strangers. How he did it, we can't quite know. He had a gift, but somehow this sad little teddy bear that found a home on Christmas merged with his memories of the previous decade. Memories of British children with suitcases in hand and tags around their neck, finding homes with strangers far from a bomb-riddled London. No questions asked. You come and stay with me, dearie. Make yourself at home. And then there were memories of continental Europeans fleeing the Third Reich, hoping to find home and acceptance on an island that somehow had managed to hold back Hitler. Bond could never quite seem to make up his mind which refugees exactly inspired him to turn that Selfridge's teddy bear into a polite young refugee from darkest Peru, who sits waiting expectantly in Paddington Station with a tag around his neck that says, "Please look after this bear." That's sort of the point, though. Bond had no shortage of options to choose from. He came of age in a world on fire, where millions of people unwillingly made a dramatic attempt to find hope in new lands. But it's not all doom and gloom. Actually, in Paddington's world, it's never doom and gloom, is it? Outside of Mr. Curry, the nosy, intrusive neighbor who is mildly unpleasant at worst, everything is great. The Brown family is unfailingly kind. We never see them questioning how they can stretch their budget to afford Paddington's marmalade addiction. One minute, Paddington was a stranger on a train platform, and the next, he was a member of the family. But as much as they love Paddington, the Browns never quite understand him, which is where Mr. Gruber, the wise shopkeeper from Hungary, comes in. Modeled on Bond's literary agent, Mr. Gruber was a refugee once himself, and he is happy to act as Paddington's guide to a London that Paddington never quite understands. Mr. Gruber and Paddington see eye to eye. They're both inherently curious about the world around them, and they're both unfailingly polite. That's the key to Paddington's appeal. Paddington is always getting into mischief. But he's not mischievous. He's kind and sweet. He just doesn't always understand his new home. Everything from escalators to theater etiquette to Guy Fawkes Day has flummoxed him. He's curious. He's always going to want to find out more. He's childlike and innocent without being guileless. He's eager to prove himself, but never at the expense of others. Intentionally, anyway. Paddington's misunderstandings invariably lead to mild chaos, something of Mr. Brown's is bound to get ruined. But everything always works out in the end. Every Paddington story, usually about 7 or 8 of them per book, follows this same arc. Paddington discovers something that didn't exist in darkest Peru, or he takes it upon himself to do something he probably shouldn't. And Mr. or Mrs. Brown say, "Paddington sure seems like he might be up to something, but That's okay. It's probably nothing, which you'd think they'd learn. And then Paddington, left to his own devices, really steps in it, and everything goes a little bit haywire. But at the end, Paddington isn't punished because what he did was actually beneficial for everyone, as it turns out. This sounds simple and pat, repeating this arc over and over again for decades, but it's truly not. The idea for Paddington, the lonely bear on the train platform, was a truly inspired one, but Michael Bond had the comedy chops to stretch that premise out for decades. The genius of the premise has overshadowed what was probably Bond's greatest gift. He was funny. A wry, understated wielder of British humor who could do as much with one of Paddington's patented hard stares.
And he gave the man one of his special hard stares. Yes, sir, said the assistant. At once, sir.
As he could with over-the-top slapstick. Even better, Bond had the versatility to write most of his stories twice. Once in print, and then again for the beloved BBC series, where he diluted his own already brisk plots down to their essence, and he often made them twice as funny in half the time. Michael Bond was truly adept at spotting weird quirks about society that might frustrate an immigrant from darkest Peru, for building situational comedy around that quirk, for escalating the situation to a slapstick climax, and finally, for de-escalating that situation in a way that makes you feel this warmth. You never end up thinking the Browns are going to say, wait, why did we pick up a stray talking bear and give him our spare room? We don't really know what life was like for the Browns before they happened across Paddington at Paddington Station. But at the end of every Paddington story, you get the sense that he has enriched their lives, shown them another way of looking at the world, and that they would happily buy him all the marmalade sandwiches as thanks for his love and affection. It was always just as simple as that. Until a decade ago.
Paddington, in a way, is a refugee. And I think his label saying, please look after this bear, is a very important ingredient.
In 2009, Paddington wrote a letter to the Prime Minister. If this sounds like the beginning of another laugh-out-loud premise for a classic Michael Bond plot, it isn't. Whenever I hear about children from foreign countries being put into detention centers, I think how lucky I am to be living at number 32 Windsor Gardens with such nice people as Mr. and Mrs. Brown. Mrs. Bird, who looks after the Browns, says if she had her way, she would set the children free and lock up a few politicians in their place to see how they liked it. Paddington's brief statement was backed up by admonitions from over 60 children's authors, including the then octogenarian Michael Bond, who also, of course, wrote that bit from Paddington, Britain's most famous refugee child. For most of his time writing Paddington, Bond never doted too much on immigration. It was his inspiration, but it was rarely his theme. That changed in recent years. For Paddington's 50th anniversary in 2008, for example, Bond wrote his first full-length Paddington book in almost 30 years, Paddington Here and Now. So what would Paddington be doing here and now? Well, the book's centerpiece was a story that saw a journalist investigating Paddington because he feared a wave of illegal immigration from darkest Peru. It did not escape Bond, even in his winter years, that since September 11, 2001, the overall attitude towards free movement around the world, a global community in which borders were suggestions, that had degraded quite a bit, and that things were only getting worse. That's not to say that the world was entirely accepting of refugees before September 11th. That would be a foolish argument. Bond may have been inspired by instances of superhuman kindness in wartime, but there are just as many, if not more, stories of extraordinary callousness that cost lives. But this has become an overwhelming preoccupation in our lives the past few years, fear of others. The world stage has been transformed by a growing isolationism that always seems to have reached its peak. That moment when we all wake up and realize we're being cruel, racist and insular when we should be compassionate. But we never quite get there. It keeps peaking. Brexit was not something that happened overnight. Britain wasn't all in on the European Union one day and all out the next. It didn't start last year, or the year before. It didn't start in 2001 either. It's an ongoing conversation that's been happening since long before there was an EU, and it's far from over. Perhaps inevitably, then, Paddington and the Brown family became shorthand for making cross-border connections in a world that seemed weary of them. Michael Bond not only did not stand in the way of this co-opting, tutting, "No, a talking bear is not the same as a Syrian child." He encouraged it. Now, you could argue that it doesn't help to turn Paddington into some explicit allegory on accepting immigrants, that children don't need to be exposed to that, that Paddington should be about compassion, but not like political compassion, and that you can't go down that road without compromising the gentle sweetness at the story's heart. But if you're making that argument, you might not have seen the Paddington movie, which manages all of this masterfully.
London is the place for me. London, that lovely city. You could go to France or America, India, Asia, Australia. You gotta come back to London.
I wrote some of this episode near the Paddington Bear store in Paddington Station. And at first, I thought that poster in the window over there was for the movie that came out back in 2014. But on closer inspection, I realized it was for Paddington 2. Paddington 2? I don't think I've ever been as blindsided by a sequel to a movie I loved as I have been by the idea of Paddington 2. It comes out in a few months. It already has a trailer.
What is your name?
Paddington?
Paddington?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what to make of a Paddington sequel.
You wear is a bear on your roof.
The trailer is not great, but to be fair, neither was the trailer for the first Paddington film. That film did not seem like a sure bet before its release. January release date, last-minute casting change in the lead role, Ben Whishaw in for Colin Firth. Michael Bond seemed ready to disown the film when it was given a PG rating. And on top of all that, just it's always a dodgy proposition to take a short story character, whether it be Pooh, Mickey Mouse, Bugs Bunny, the Smurfs, Scooby-Doo, Yogi Bear, what have you, and then to attempt to stretch their essence out to feature-length proportions doesn't work a lot. To reach feature-length, the Paddington film goes deep on the one question that never seemed to bother Michael Bond or his characters all that much. Why are there talking bears? In Bond's books, look, I mean, some bears in Darkest Brew just talk, and they love marmalade, and they love London. His version of world-building is, "I built this world. Hope you like it." Because why not? In the film, though, it's not enough to build a world. You have to show your work.
An undiscovered species of bear. Time to collect a specimen for the museum. I thought my time was up. My ticket was punched. But the bear saved my life. He guided me through the jungle to show me his world. And in return, I introduced him to ours.
An explorer, Montgomery Clyde, found the bears in Darkest Peru, and he's the one who taught them to talk and love marmalade and always take one's hat off when greeting someone. Because of him, and because of the consequences brought on by the civility that he shows to the bears, Paddington isn't just some charming vignettes. No, Paddington has a plot, and it has a villain, and it has an origin myth, complete with a natural disaster and, yes, the tragic death of a father figure. I mean, come on, does Paddington Bear really need an origin story? This should have been a disaster. And in some ways, it is a bit of a disaster. Paddington is really two movies. One is a family comedy. The other is a fast-paced thriller filled with dart guns. The Dart Gun thriller, which stars Nicole Kidman, is not very good, though it is really interesting on an allegorical level. Her character talks about bears from Darkest Peru like we talk about people who come from places that we don't understand.
And being such a pillar of the community, I can see why having that beast move in next door would upset you so.
I suppose I should be grateful that it's only one bear.
Oh, but it always starts with just one, Mr. Curry. Soon the whole street will be crawling with them. Drains clogged with fur, buns thrown at old ladies, raucous all-night picnics.
What can we do?
And this has grounding. The defining moment in that character's life, her father's humiliation at the hands of the Geographers Guild, is a reminder that our current fear and misunderstanding of the other is a symptom of centuries of believing that the only civilization was Western civilization.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, I mean, these were no dumb beasts. I mean, they were intelligent and civilized.
Oh, come off it, Clyde. They didn't even speak English.
Well, no, but...
Do they play cricket?
Drink tea?
Do the crossword?
Pretty rum idea of civilization you've got, Clyde.
That doesn't make Kidman's performance great, but it really gives you some ideas to chew on. As for the other film, the family comedy, it's just about perfect. Here, too, in the Brown household, there's more world-building that shows the work. Is it strictly necessary? No, but it is dramatically satisfying. Unlike Michael Bond's Brown family, the Browns of the film are not this happy family before they happen across a bear at Paddington Station, and accordingly, they don't immediately decide that adopting this stranger is a practical thing to do. Mr. Brown is extremely risk-averse, and an unknown foreigner is a risk. Teenage daughter Judy feels like she doesn't fit in already. What if someone sees her hanging out with someone from darkest Peru? Plus, it's just not what people do. They may have once, in some long-ago time that Paddington has heard about in stories.
There was once a war in the explorer's country. Thousands of children were sent away for safety, left at railway stations with labels around their necks, and unknown families took them in and loved them like their own. They will not have forgotten how to treat a stranger.
But that's not the reality of the modern world.
We're not giving you a home.
Oh? It's just for the night.
Oh.
You see, when a young person comes to this country, I'm afraid they don't just move in with the first people they meet.
No?
That's not the world Paddington finds.
London is not how we imagined it. Hardly anyone says hello or wears hats, and you can no longer simply turn up at the station and get a home. It's hard to see where a bear could ever belong in such a strange, cold city.
It's certainly a darker vision than the one Bond put forward in 1958. Bond's is a world where, within one day, a family of middle-class Brits can decide, without reservation, that they should adopt a stranger they found on a train platform. Some darkness was implied subtextually, for instance, for Paddington to have ended up at Platform 1 waiting for someone to come along, one imagines he must have been ignored by some other families. But the film imagines that moment of despair for us.
Good morning. Really tipping it down, isn't it? Oh, strange. How do you do? I'm just looking for a home, and I... Oh.
The camera tracks up, hello? Up, up, as Paddington is lost in a sea of Londoners who don't return his polite greeting because they don't even care he's there. I won't dote too much on the visuals of Paddington because this is sort of an audio experience, but I need to dote on them a little. I think Paddington should be shown in film schools. It is a masterclass in strategically breaking from realism to convey heightened emotions. The film can get sad, but the valleys make the peaks all the more thrilling. Every 5 or 10 minutes, there's an absolutely exhilarating use of visual storytelling that takes my breath away. From the crackling newsreel footage that opens the film, to the snowball to the lens that ends it, this film allows its camera to come totally unmoored from anything resembling mundanity. To introduce us to the quirks of the Brown family, the camera tracks up and down a cross-section of a dollhouse that resides in the attic, which emphasizes how boxed in everyone in the family is. A painted tree that sprawls up the wall of the Browns' parlor, winding through a spiral staircase, acts as a sort of mood ring for the film. It sheds all its leaves when the tone of the film gets despairing, and then it sways lushly when all is well again. There's this moment where Paddington, seeing the newsreel that opened the film for the first time, walks through the screen like it's mist, which allows him to physically explore his homesickness. When we meet Mr. Gruber, he discusses his own refugee experience, which plays out in miniature within one of the model trains in his shop. I really adore this film. I have to confess, before researching this episode, I'd never read any Paddington stories. That means when I heard that Michael Bond, the author of the Paddington series, had passed away at 91, I thought, man, Paddington, what a wonderful movie. Now, Bond, as versatile a writer as he was, having written the BBC animated series and all, he did not write the movie. Yes, it is probably odd for me to end what is essentially a eulogy to Michael Bond with praise for the one Paddington story in which he ostensibly took no part. But I'm going to stick with my guns. I first heard about Paddington when Michael Bond was 88, 89 years old. Some kid later this year who goes to see Paddington 2 will first come across this wonderful character after Bond has left us. Michael Bond lived a deliriously long time, from the birth of television to making YouTube videos. But his bear will outlive him. Good. We need him. He is crucial to the conversation we are having every day, in government buildings, in schools, on the street. Paddington may not be real, not tangible, like the train station that inspired him. But the influence he has on people is real. The best lessons are the ones you don't even know you're learning. Like another beloved British character who has turned a commuter hub into a tourist destination, Paddington has changed people's views without those people being aware of the transformation. That's the hardest but most rewarding part about writing children's literature. It's not writing down to an audience that doesn't understand adult things. It's not hiding the darkness of the world. Children can cope with darkness. Now, the hardest thing is the responsibility of channeling light and dark into an ethos that prepares someone for life as it is and gives the ammunition to transform life into what it can be. On that note, I can't possibly come up with an outro better than the one the writers of Paddington crafted, so I'll let them do the honors.
Mrs. Brown says that in London, everyone is different, but that means anyone can fit in. I think she must be right, because although I don't look like anyone else, I really do feel at home. I will never be like other people, but that's all right, because I am a bear. A bear called Paddington.
Come on, Paddington!
I had to laugh till I couldn't laugh no more. Had an old China man out on the floor. Pass me by, hopping like a clown. I told myself that he really going to talk. But there was also a Roger gentleman. Americans and British...
Thanks for listening in. If you've enjoyed this memorial episode to Michael Bond and his creation, Paddington, then be sure to rate and review the podcast in iTunes and, of course, subscribe. Next time, Dunkirk.